It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll take our weekly look at the news out of Washington with Central Time political correspondent Harry Enten.
First, the plight of Syrian refugees pouring into Turkey and Western Europe is a large concern for European Union countries and the United Nations. But what's going on inside Syria also has global implications.
The situation became more complex today as Russian jets conducted airstrikes in parts of the country.
Joining us to discuss Russian aims in the Middle East and President Vladimir Putin's recent address at the meeting of the United Nations General Assembly is David McDonald. He's a UW-Madison history professor and an expert on the politics of contemporary Russia. David, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we have these Russian airstrikes in Syria this morning. President Putin said these are limited. They're aimed at ISIS fighters. Others, including some American sources, saying these strikes are not happening where ISIS is. These might be rebels, other rebels, trying to overturn Syrian President Assad. So what might Putin's aims be in undertaking these airstrikes?
Well, I think, first of all, we've got to get confirmation of the information on the designation of the strikes themselves. I was just looking at recent reports in the Russian press, and they have a ticker that says that thus far the White House has yet to confirm that the airstrikes took place in the proximity of the so-called moderate opposition. But that said, I think there are several things going on with Putin's thinking or his security think tank's thinking on the utility of this approach to going after ISIS. Probably first and foremost is, and we heard it foreshadowed in the UN address. I think one thing underlying his whole approach to this part of the world is to defend the principle of the sovereignty of established governments. That if nothing else, right now you've got to establish a stable Syrian state and go after ISIS before you can even talk about the fate of Assad Syria or whether there will be a transition out. He gave a lecture in the UN about the folly of fostering state destruction in places like Libya, and that during the Arab Spring, and said that the other powers should take a lesson from that. And in the back of his mind, too, I also think he's still thinking of the arguments that he made against the Maidan in Ukraine and his involvement there. And finally, in a very different setting than in the European theater, he is staking his claim to Russia's presence as a power and a player in the Middle East, part of a general reassertion of Russian stature in geopolitical questions since, 2008 or so.
And that point about Assad seems to be the key sticking point. Russia, the United States, just about everybody agrees, hey, it's a good thing if we work together against ISIS. The U.S. says Assad, just as bad in many ways, his attacks on civilians driving this refugee crisis in part. But as you say, Putin saying, no, Assad is the closest thing to a stable government we've got. That's got to be our starting point. Do you see those two views reconciled? Will either side give way, at least temporarily?
Well, there seem to be straws in the wind. From what I'm reading, Secretary of State John Kerry has suggested that there might be some willingness in Washington to accept some solution that understands Assad as a placeholder, and then but also as one who will immediately go into transition once the broader crisis in the stability represented by ISIS or ISIL is taken care of.
Syria has been seen as Russia's only staging area base, ally maybe, in the Middle East under President Assad. Is that part of why they are here today doing what they're doing?
Well, I think there will be people in certainly the Russian armed forces that will remind outsiders that they have a Mediterranean port in Tartus on the Mediterranean on the Syrian coast, and that represents Russia's only naval post outside of the territory of the current Russian Federation. I was about to say Sevastopol was the other one, but of course, since last March, Sevastopol has miraculously re-entered, and I say that ironically, the Russian Federation. So it's there. For them, it's a very important staging area. The other thing that I think Russian security experts would remind all of us of is the fact that, unlike us, Russia is geographically contiguous to this area, that they've been dealing with the spillover from the rise of militant and armed Islamism, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIL or any one of another, any one of a number of organized formations since the outbreak of the original Chechen conflicts in the early 1990s. So they feel they demand respect for a certain proprietary interest in this area that they believe other powers don't have.
Talking to Russia expert David McDonald from UW-Madison about today's airstrikes by Russia in Syria, targeting, they say, ISIS or ISIL, the terrorist group there. There have been accusations, David, that Russia is taking action here to distract from what's happening closer to their borders. There are activities in Ukraine. You mentioned the Crimea a few moments ago. Anything to that, do you think?
It's really hard to tell. There's an image. There's an image abroad of Putin as sort of a grand marionetteer and conducting this really highly coordinated and mutually reinforcing global strategy. That might be so, but it seems certainly that events in Syria and Russia's willingness or eagerness to intervene do have the temporary benefit of distracting everybody's attention from Ukraine. For what it's worth, I'll note in passing, again, I was looking at a couple of Russian press sources I trust, and one of them noted that given the ceasefire in Donbass right now, that several of the so-called rebels have volunteered to serve as fighters against ISIS in Syria. This, I should note, occurs right under a story in which President Putin tells his defense counsel that Russia has no interest at all in burdening itself with a ground presence in Syria. So there might be connections, but other people would tell you that he has become locked into what one might call a game of geopolitical whack-a-mole, and he's just defending his interests where he can. And we might be establishing connections as much as anything else.
So in addition to the UN meeting, President Putin, President Obama met this week. I think it was characterized as a bit frosty, their talk, maybe an understatement. Do you see room for serious cooperation, maybe coordination with the U.S. and Russia in a place like Syria?
Well, when I looked at that, I was thinking, which of them has any interest in domestic context in appearing to be amenable to the other? It would appear to be a sign of concession or weakness on both their parts, and they both have domestic audiences that are demanding quite the opposite, an assertive policy vis-a-vis the other. Do I think that excludes future cooperation? No, I don't. I think that one thing that has happened very recently is the Russians have begun organizing what they call a coalition that will be an intelligence-sharing consortium involving the Russians, the Iranis, the Iraqis, and the Syrians, which, if it comes to fruition, they're projecting it for the end of next month, we could either construe it as a threat or as a chance to have some sort of mediation with the chief players in the area and through Iraq as a means to coordinate with the Russians. I also see signs that the U.S. Defense Agency or the Department of Defense is at least willing to contemplate the possibility of coordination. What it's going to boil down to is how seriously they really take the threat of ISIL, and if they agree that that's the primary strategic threat, and they can agree to conjoin in dealing with that, then they can deal with the other questions afterwards.
Yeah, before the UN, Obama had said something along the lines of, we'll work with any country, including Russia and Iran, on this issue. Putin said we need something like the anti-Hitler coalition, where the then-Soviet Union and the United States were able to work together despite their differences.
Yep.
Are they both quietly paving the way, maybe, toward that kind of coordination?
Well, I think in different ways and for different reasons and to different extents, I think each group and each leader and their advisors are really they've tried various approaches towards dealing with this ISIL threat. It's both countries and other countries throughout Europe and North America have newspaper stories about their domestics, their citizens, going to fight on the side of ISIS in ISIL in the Middle East. And I think they're finally starting to realize that this threat's not going away through a lack of momentum or a lack of funds, that it's had a lot longer legs than they expected. So I think there is a prospect for some form of limited cooperation, and I think they're starting to come around to that.
David, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's David McDonald, UW-Madison Professor of History and an expert on the politics of contemporary Russia. It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. John Boehner is out as Speaker of the House. He'll leave Congress completely at the end of October. And today is the deadline for Congress to avoid a government shutdown.
Joining us now for a look at those and other top stories is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So one day after hosting Pope Francis for a speech to Congress, Speaker of the House John Boehner announced that he's going to leave Congress at the end of October. How big of a surprise was that to people in Washington?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I think that there has always been this thought that Boehner's time was sort of limited or coming to an end, but I don't think most people thought it was going to happen this quickly. I mean, it was just a week before where he says, oh, I'm not stepping down. What are you, crazy? I guess a week is in politics is a lifetime. And I think Boehner just basically recognized the facts that were on the ground, that it was going to be very difficult to pass this budget. They probably were going to be able to do so, but he would have to spend a lot of political capital. And more than that, the people who would be supporting him, and let's say if there was a leadership fight, were getting a lot of pressure from their constituents. And it just the juice just wasn't worth the squeeze anymore. Where I think Boehner recognized, look, I want this budget to get passed. I want the Republican caucus to get along, and while I could stay in top, it just wasn't worth the fight.
Just coincidence that this happened the day after the papal visit, which presumably was something that mattered a lot to John Boehner.
I don't know if it's coincidence or not. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, obviously Boehner is a Roman Catholic, so he was very much touched. He spoke about the Pope a number of times, both when he announced his resignation and to reporters the night before. So I think, of course, it may have been a spiritual experience for him. But whether or not that was what ultimately caused it is between him and the Pope and him and God.
Now, for whom is Boehner's departure seen as a victory or a defeat?
This is what the beautiful thing about politics is. It can be seen as a victory or defeat for any number of people. I think it's seen as a victory, you know, certainly for Tea Party types, for the Freedom Caucus. You know, they had wanted him to get out. But who are they replacing him with? They're replacing him with Kevin McCarthy, who, according to most ideological measures, is actually to the left of John Boehner. You know, Democrats see this as, oh, the Republicans are going crazy, and it's going to be great. We'll be able to say Republicans are crazy, but Republicans are going to get the budget passed. It seems that Republicans are coming together. But, of course, we'll have another budget showdown coming up sooner rather than later. So we'll see if Republicans are actually able to keep it together, how long the honeymoon period for Kevin McCarthy, who is probably going to be the speaker, will actually last.
What do we know about Kevin McCarthy?
Well, we know, you know, Kevin McCarthy is a representative from out in California. He's risen up the ladder very, very quickly. I believe he's the fastest person to reach the speakership since the 1890s. And what's also very interesting is in a country that's becoming more diverse, but a Republican Party whose base is still mostly white Americans, his district is 35% Latino. So, you know, on a subject such as immigration, it'll be interesting to see if maybe McCarthy is able to move the party a little bit more towards a centrist position. Of course, the Republican Party has been hesitant to do so, so we'll see.
It's been quite a ride, hasn't it? Eric Cantor was seen as the likely successor to Boehner. Now, it's sort of anyone's guess what direction the Republican Party is going to go in, I mean, because there's not just one strand of conservatism going forward.
Yeah, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, a moment in politics is a lifetime. You have to strike when the iron is hot. And it was just, you know, a year and a half ago when it looked like Eric Cantor was going to be in a perfect position to become the first Jewish speaker in the House of Representatives. And then he gets defeated in a primary by David Bratt in Virginia, an upset that nobody saw was coming. But Kevin McCarthy has proven himself to be a shrewd politician, proven himself to be able to reach across the different factions of the Republican Party. And I think that's one of the things that needs to be kept in mind. It's not just about your ideological record. It's how you get along with colleagues. At the end of the day, the Congress is still a buddy-buddy club with 435 members in the House of Representatives. And if you lose, you know, support from members of your caucus, even if you're the most conservative guy, which you can if you're just not a nice guy, then you're worth nothing versus someone like Kevin McCarthy, who clearly has good human relations skills, has been able to rise up the ladder, and at this point he probably will become the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, and he joins us every week to talk about the latest in politics. And so Kevin McCarthy, presuming he does, as you say, and everybody else is saying, and he ascends to this position of Speaker of the House, is he stepping into an impossible job, even with those impeccable people skills that you just mentioned?
You know, it's always interesting to see what happens. But look, the facts on the ground are still what they were. You have a large Republican majority in the House of Representatives, and you have a Senate which, although it has a Republican majority, is not one that's a filibuster-proof majority, so you're going to see Democrats still blocking legislation. And you have a president of the United States who, whether Republicans like it or not, is still a Democrat, who is not going to sign things that are not favorable to Democratic positions. So if you have Republican legislators on the far right who are saying, oh, we have to push for more conservative pieces of legislation, you have those constituents back home who are saying push for this, and then they can't actually get it through, and they're going, what's going on? Those facts haven't changed at all. John Boehner was not responsible for the fact that President Obama was the President of the United States. So it's going to be interesting to see if Kevin McCarthy can actually calm down people and say, you know what, let's ride out the storm, let's get through the next year, let's not do anything foolish, and let's see if we can get a Republican president. And if they can do so, then maybe they can pass some more conservative legislation. But at this point, it's not like all of a sudden Kevin McCarthy comes in and everyone's going to join hands together and sing Kumbaya. The facts on the ground are still the same.
Well, I got to ask you, in your estimation, what accounts for doing something foolish? What would that be?
I think something foolish might be something along the lines of another government shutdown. You know, although Republicans were able to win a number of seats in 2014 and were able to take back the majority in the Senate, I think a government shutdown is something that would be foolish. Most voters don't want it. Most voters would blame Republicans. I think, you know, tying a government shutdown to Planned Parenthood funding would be something that would be very foolish because even a majority of Republicans don't want that. I think, you know, just the overall rhetoric and tone of going after President Obama in a disrespectful fashion. There's certainly Democrats who go after Republicans in a disrespectful fashion, but most voters at this point believe it's the Republican Party that is holding things up in Washington. So I think just a calming of the waters, a calming down, keeping the tone respectful, I think is just very, very key moving forward.
And we're going to come back to that possible shutdown in a bit. But first, you know, we've got Boehner stepping down, and then you've also got these calls for Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, to step down as well. What are the complaints against McConnell?
I mean, you know, it's the same complaints as they were against Boehner. Oh, he's moving things along. He's trying to pass legislation. You know, he's giving too much into President Obama. These are the same exact calls that were made against John Boehner. The difference being, I think, in the Senate is, first off, the Republicans in the Senate tend to be a little bit more moderate than the Republicans in the House of Representatives. A number of Republican senators, you know, are representing states that are much more purplish. You've seen senators such as Kelly Ayotte up in New Hampshire saying, you know, we don't want this government shut down. There's no purpose to it. So to me, the calls ring a little more hollow and are going to be a little bit more difficult to actually adhere to. And you've already heard people, senators going after Ted Cruz, who's been, you know, trying to charge up, saying we have to bring the fight to the Democrats, and saying, Ted Cruz, back off. You know, you don't need to be doing what you're doing. So to me, yeah, there's obviously a chance. Look, if the Boehner thing has taught me anything, it's never say never. You just don't know what happened tomorrow. But I think McConnell is in a much better position than John Boehner ever was.
Okay, and so getting back to that possible shutdown today, the deadline is for Congress to avoid a government shutdown, I should say, and the Senate passed a continuation bill that would keep the government funded until December 11th. So what happens now, and where are we?
Well, I mean, you know, that was part of the reason that John Boehner did agree to step down was he wanted, you know, to be able to get this continuing resolution so that the government would be funded. And it was thought that if he did, then there would be some goodwill. And that does seem to be coming into fruition, whereby the government will not be shut down. But Boehner's going to be gone in a month, and then we're going to face the same thing in December. And who knows where we're going to be in December. I think it's a matter of, you know, how angry is the Republican Congress? How well does Kevin McCarthy's first days as Speaker go? You know, it's one thing to sit on the sidelines and say, I'm going to bring everybody together. It's another thing to actually go into action and then do it. And so we'll see. Who knows how Kevin McCarthy will be a Speaker? If he's risen so fast, he can't be all that bad in terms of bringing the caucus together. But being the top man is different than being the second of top man.
And Harry, just very briefly, what is your take on how all this jockeying politically is spilling over into the presidential race?
I think Kevin McCarthy was the consensus choice. There hasn't been, you know, too much discussion going on in the presidential race, except for Ted Cruz, who continues to be someone who's not well-liked by the party. If he were better liked by the party, and he is conservative as he was, he might be in better shape in the presidential race. But right now, Ted Cruz is just getting in the way of Ted Cruz.
Well, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for a look at the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. By the year 2030, almost 26% of Wisconsin's population will be 60 and older, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Wisconsin is one of the few states where there are more baby boomers than millennials. And currently, Wisconsin has the 14th largest baby boomer population in the country.
Well, there's a growing number of adults in the state. Healthcare professionals aren't getting any different training to help understand some of the unique challenges that older populations can face.
That's where a new program called Gear Up comes in. Gear Up stands for Geriatrics Equipped and Ready for Unsupervised Practice. It's a statewide effort to enhance how healthcare workers are trained to care for older adults.
We're taking your calls on this. Have you experienced some of the unique challenges that older adults face for yourself or in your family? How have you handled some of these healthcare challenges? Call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dr. Stephen Barzi is with us now to talk about Gear Up and some of the efforts to train healthcare professionals to treat older adults. He's a professor of medicine in the areas of geriatrics and gerontology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Barzi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
So why is it important for healthcare professionals around the state to receive special training when it comes to caring for older adults?
So we oftentimes will learn from the example of, say, pediatrics. Most of us would be very uncomfortable treating a 5-year-old the same way we would a 25-year-old. And it turns out that oftentimes older adults, when people move from, say, age 40 to 60 to 80, there are pretty substantial changes that occur that can set people up for different health conditions. They oftentimes are on a lot more medications. The psychosocial complexity of these individuals becomes much more significant. And it requires a slightly different approach in working with that group.
And before we get into what healthcare providers will be learning under Gear Up, is part of the answer here that we need more people like you, people who specialize in geriatrics and gerontology here in the state?
Well, certainly, I think that it's important to have those who can teach in the field and serve as special consultants. But equally important, there just needs to be a greater depth of information and knowledge on managing older adults across the whole healthcare field. So within primary care providers, specialty providers, with pharmacists, social workers, nurse practitioners, the whole group really needs to kind of be prepared to best serve that population.
Well, you mentioned differences, say, between a 5-year-old and a 20 or 40-year-old. What are some of the unique healthcare challenges for people over 60 that healthcare workers that you just mentioned need to be aware of?
Sure. So the common health problems that do tend to afflict people more often in later life include cognitive difficulties, memory changes, and that doesn't just mean kind of the serious conditions like dementia, but that may mean more subtle types of issues. Balance and falling can be a big factor, and that can be a quick way for a person to end up becoming dependent and often maybe even institutionalized. Medication prescribing, different medicines at different doses are oftentimes appropriate for older adults, bone health. There's just a host of factors that may not automatically be part of a health professional's training before they start working with older adults.
And we were talking just before we came on the air about interactions between all these different things that you mentioned, physical conditions, medications, maybe even mental or emotional conditions. Does that become a really important issue for a doctor working with seniors?
Absolutely. And in fact, the complexity becomes such that it's very difficult for any one provider alone to really be able to fully meet the needs of an older adult and also their family. And so that's where teams come in. And we really have been focusing in the field of geriatrics on team care because no one person has the unique expertise. And so you pull together a bunch of people who each can offer something. And that provides, I think, the best care.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Barzee from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about the unique needs of Wisconsin's aging population. We're going to have more older adults here in the state, according to census numbers. There's a new effort to train healthcare providers to work with that aging population. Let's get into the practical side of this Gear Up program. How will you reach out to healthcare providers? What kind of training will they get?
Certainly. So the idea is that there is a core curriculum. There are some core skills and competencies that all health providers should probably know. And our group, which happens to represent not just the UW-Madison, but also members from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Marquette University, the Alzheimer's Association, Aurora Healthcare, we've come together and we've defined what these kinds of curricula are. We've targeted various learner groups, including those at the earlier stages of their training, as well as those out in practice. And the idea is to try to provide the educational approaches that are convenient for them, which is tricky because many health providers are very overtaxed. And as far as that goes, we're looking at things from a competency-based perspective. So gone are the days when everyone just would study a book and learn the knowledge. We now really need to be able to demonstrate that we understand how to do certain types of approaches and skills and such. And so it's a lot more direct observation and the like.
Well, talk us through, you mentioned falls earlier as an important issue, one that can lead to very negative health outcomes for seniors. What kind of things would a healthcare provider be talking about training on, getting this feedback on dealing with falls?
Certainly. So one thing is that to recognize that falls are not inevitable, and there are a number of risk factors that people can have that can set them up for falling. It can be medication effects. It can be weakness in the legs. It could be influence of arthritic changes. There are many factors. And just even recognizing what those risk factors are, noticing, for example, that there's several high-risk medications that might predispose a person to falling, and then intervening. Or making an appropriate referral to a physical therapist early on before a person has a catastrophic fall. These are just a few examples, but we really know from the evidence and the science that's evolving that we can intervene and we can reduce a person's chances for a disruptive fall.
You used the phrase inevitable, actually not inevitable there, and I wanted to follow that up more generally. I think there are a lot of things that happen, and we assume that's just aging. It's just natural. It happens. Part of the training maybe to get healthcare providers to not make that assumption.
Yeah, and there is that age bias out there. I mean, we all have observations we make around us. And yet we're learning more and more that lots of chronic health problems that are commonly seen with older adults aren't necessarily the parts of aging. And we have to tease that out. And that is important for us to try to help the many health providers to recognize what is not aging, what is pathology.
One issue a lot of people are concerned about for themselves, for older family members, are the various kinds of dementia. What kind of training would the Gear Up program involve to help people watch for that and maybe provide early treatment?
Certainly. So the whole issue of recognizing when a person has a memory problem or cognitive impairment may not always be obvious with just a conversation. And many times the conversations that happen between primary providers and their patients are limited by time substantially. Yet there are more objective ways by which we can test individuals in a way that's not threatening to them and provides them with some, you know, continued dignity. And so to even give the tools or the skills for those providers to quickly themselves or with their nurses to intervene and do a cognitive assessment and know what types of historical information are important for identifying maybe a very early memory illness can be the beginnings of both education as well as medical intervention.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Barzee from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about a new statewide effort called Gear Up to better train healthcare professionals to care for older adults around the state.
We're picking up our discussion now with geriatrics expert Dr. Stephen Barzee about the unique healthcare challenges that older adults face and what healthcare professionals in Wisconsin are doing to get ready for the aging of our population.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have your health needs changed as you've aged? What do you wish you'd gotten from your doctor, nurse, other healthcare providers for yourself or for a family member? And if you are one of those providers, how are you seeing this play out from your end? What kind of training do you wish you had? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Donna on the line in Hartford. Donna, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, great. Thank you for taking my call, and this is such a timely and fascinating program. Doctor, I have a direct question for you regarding the drug Valium, and I just heard you say, you know, there are certain drugs that, if given to older adults, affect them very differently than someone younger. Very quickly, I will tell you, this was a one-time pill, one pill. We double-checked the specific amount with the pharmacy according to my mom's weight. She was about 83 and a half years old at the time, so 2012, and she has scoliosis and osteoporosis and is severely limited mobility-wise in her spine. So laying flat for her does never happen, but they needed to try to get a CT scan. A brand-new urologist, or he was brand-new to us, and a young doctor, decided that she should try taking a Valium before trying to get on the x-ray table because they needed to get the CT scan. So he said, take it before you go to the hospital. Well, we live 5 minutes away from the hospital, and so on a beautiful day, she took the pill. Was experiencing no symptoms. It had to be on an empty stomach, of course, because CT scan. And she stood up with her lift chair, with her walker, as per usual. I was about 10 feet across the room from her. It had my back to her. She stood up and immediately blacked out, fell flat on her face.
Donna, I'm really sorry to hear about this story. And Dr. Barzee, I know you can't deal with a specific medical issue here or prescribe or diagnose everything over the phone, but her story raises the point of watching for unexpected drug side effects, maybe interactions when prescribing to senior patients. Can you talk about that broader issue?
Absolutely, and it's incredibly relevant because there's a host of meds we call potentially inappropriate medicines, which we know influence older adults in a very different way than typical adults. This is a great example because Valium is an agent that has a very long half-life, and we tend to really try to avoid using it in older adults because the risks for falls and for confusion go up dramatically. Yet, that the doctor you were talking about, I'm sure, had no intentions to be harming your mother, but by not understanding that that's a med that would be this potentially inappropriate medication, it was prescribed. And this kind of a story plays out all the time when we look at complications in older adults.
Donna, thanks for calling. Good luck to you and your mom. We'll go back to our callers with Duncan in Oshkosh now. Duncan, hi.
Yes. My mother's had a lot of issues, vascular in her legs, heart bypass, and so over all that time, she's seen a lot of different doctors, and I think, Stephen, you're right, the primary care doctor is the main man. My mother's had two. She had one, and I respect him a lot, and he would go to Africa and help out, but then he was gone one time, and this other one in the same place, it clicked, and and so one time she was going to get this surgery because the arteries going up into her head were thinning out. And so this surgeon came, so I'm there with her in the bed, they're prepping her, and he says, well, oh, no, this ain't right. And so we did everything, and there's not a doctor that I've seen that I dislike. It's got to be the toughest job, and the tough thing is when family members aren't with older people that are in pain, anyway.
Duncan, I you bring up two really interesting points. First, coordination when you've got a bunch of different specialists. Is it important for that primary care doctor or maybe a nurse or a physician's assistant to be the quarterback, making sure everything is getting coordinated?
Yes, and certainly the more medical conditions, the more specialists that are involved, the greater the degree of coordination is required, as well as the more good communication there is with all parties. It brings up the other point, which is the role of family, which is pivotal. You know, families become the key advocates oftentimes when an individual becomes more frail or maybe more cognitively affected. And health providers need to have really good skills in having communication with families, producing very effective family care meetings. And so this is all part of that team process and part of good care for an older adult.
Duncan, thanks a lot for that call. As we talk to Dr. Stephen Barzee about efforts to train healthcare providers in Wisconsin when it comes to taking care of the needs of the state's aging population. And Dr. Barzee, I wanted to ask what you mentioned that you are focusing on the newcomers, the people going into the field now. Is there some kind of a continuing education effort out there for people who have already been doctors, nurses, et cetera, for 10, 20 years?
Yes. So the particular grant actually focuses on the whole continuum, starting at, say, medical students, pharmacy students, nursing students, but moving all the way out to those who have been in practice for some time. And physicians that are in practice have ongoing requirements for maintaining their certification. And this maintenance of certification is a very complicated issue. But suffice it to say that there are very effective ways for people to, in practice, still continue to learn. And it's more than just big conferences. And so our approach is trying to work with various health systems in the state on these maintenance of certification activities through some of our colleagues in Milwaukee.
We heard from Marlene on Facebook, who has some recommendations. She says, look the patient in the eye, not the computer, and listen. 2, empathy needed. 3, communication with all the doctors that the patient sees. Probably good advice for a doctor dealing with any patient, I suppose. But is there a bedside manner, a communication style that's part of this effort to work with older adults?
Yeah, and it all comes back to the skills of listening and perception, as well recognizing certain barriers that can make interactions more complicated, such as hearing impairment and vision impairment, for example, or even subtle cognitive changes. We need to make sure when we're communicating, we're speaking in English rather than in medicalese, because we tend to use a lot of medical terminology. And that type of communication, and doing so in a, what I would say is a slower type of time, because it just takes longer for people to process information. And so those are a couple of considerations.
Thanks for that comment, Marlene. Back to our callers now. We've got Margaret on the line in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work for a Center for Independent Living, which is a non-residential organization that assists people with disabilities, and that can include older adults. One thing that we think about, we encourage people a lot, is to make sure that their living environment is accessible to them so that they're not putting themselves at risk of getting injuries. And that's something that people can think about as they get older. The concept that we talk about is called aging in place. So thinking about, you know, are there a lot of steps getting into their home, which is common in Wisconsin? Or what does the bathroom look like? You know, could you use a wheelchair in there? And another thing that we know happens is that people will leave the hospital after a surgery or maybe an injury, and they haven't had any kind of education or even been asked by, you know, their doctor, how are you going to get into your house? How are you going to take a bath? So things like that, where they might need a bath chair or something like that to prevent further injury. Those are things that medical professionals could and should be asking people. You know,
Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. We're just about out of time. Dr. Barzee, is this part of the effort to make sure that patients go home and they go home to a place that they're safe?
Absolutely. Margaret, you bring up excellent points. It's critical for us to understand the environment. It's very important for us to manage that care transition. And it's also very important to engage with community groups and community providers, such as your organization. That all has to be part of the big picture for working with an older adult.
Thanks a lot for the call, Margaret. Dr. Barzee, how successful do you think this statewide effort, Gear Up, and the partners you're working with will be in getting better outcomes for patients by treating these medical professionals or training these medical professionals?
Certainly, that's the intent, and that's what the federal government is hoping for. We are really, through this team effort, anticipating that this is going to be a work in progress over a period of years. And this is initially a three-year funded grant or project. And we have it all planned out such that each of our different sites will be having outcomes that will look at not only the effectiveness of the teaching processes and the outcomes of the learning, but also, as you're describing, the outcomes that impact patients most. And so it'll be both on the learner outcomes, but also looking at the patient care outcomes.
Dr. Barzee, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Dr. Stephen Barzee, professor of medicine in the areas of geriatrics and gerontology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us to talk about a new statewide effort to train healthcare professionals to be geriatrics capable.
Wisconsin's DNR is trying to get the word out to reassure people that they are, in fact, allowed to display decorative concrete deer in their yards.
Why? It turns out some state residents had received official-looking warnings on official-looking letterhead advising them to bring their concrete decorative deer inside. The reason the DNR would be doing a deer census and, quote, some ornaments may have been counted over the past 2 years by mistake.
The letter went up on social media and got an official denial from the DNR, which posted the hoax letter on their Facebook page. Apparently, DNR staff are capable of distinguishing concrete deer from the real live animals.
There were a couple of clues that this might not be the real deal. The name of the DNR's deputy secretary is spelled two different ways on the document, and he's promoted from deputy secretary to full-on secretary at the end. So why? What was the motive here? Is there some, like, underground anti-concrete deer contingent?
I don't know. It's just kind of a fun, whimsical prank, I think. I am an advocate of concrete deer.
Sure.
I think they're a Wisconsin tradition. I could get on board with someone who wanted to play a prank trying to get rid of those figures bending over, you know, those concrete ones.
See the underwear. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
that would be okay.
So the lesson, if you get mysterious warnings about deer, exercise prudence. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.